I have many people out there at my auctions, and I babble for 3, 4 hours, and I sell them trinkets, and it was the lousiest commodity in the world, generally speaking, and I wasn't inspired at all with what I was doing, and I found very little satisfaction in the money I derived, and I thought, well, what a waste of time and voice and effort and energy. And I wanted to do what you folks had done. But this was rather late in life when I realized this. And I wished that my ministers that knew me as a younger fellow had recognized possibly that I had a tendency for this type of thing and just come up to me and said, Irv, did you ever think of going into the ministry or something of this sort? And had they done that, I might have gone into the ministry and be sitting in your seat. But then again, maybe this isn't what the Lord wanted. But the point is, I think you've got to be proud of what you're doing, because it's the greatest in my opinion. And I mingle with bank presidents, and we fly the Nixon for president committee, the Rockefeller for president committee, we fly the a congressman out of Washington, D.C. I know most of them personally. And I want you to know that none of them have got vocations like you've got. Not one. Their motivations are so insignificant compared to the ones you have. And I really envy every one of you for your vocations. And if you can live with the trivial individuals that are in your parish that might criticize you sometimes because of their narrow perspectives, I would say that these things should never bother you. What you're doing is too big to be, and to let it destroy your enthusiasm, your sincerity, and the thing that put you there to start with. I heard the president Hamlin University say proudly they had 3 of their graduating class that was going on to seminary. And it's my guess that when those 300 kids came there initially, that there was probably at least 100 of them had looked towards the ministry. But what happened to them in the interim? Why did only 3 of them, why was only 3 of them sufficiently inspired that they went on to the seminary? I think that possibly this percentage is a result of the influences of the world, maybe. So you guys got a real big job to do. You got some powerfully advertising men to overcome. You've got the conformity pattern to overcome, and you've got the so many things to overcome, and you by golly, it's going to take a big man, but I think you can do it. And I'm sure happy that I was sitting in your class here, Shorty, this time. I think everybody that's here is fortunate. And I feel bad for those that couldn't attend, because they'll be better ministers for it. But this is just a layman thinking. And I'll tell you, you can be real tremendous enthusiastic filled, and I believe I haven't got a commodity that approaches yours.
I like your statements, but I think one is really so far-fetched that you should almost apologize for it. It's really a bad statement.
Let's have it. Lay it on the line that we agree that should be done.
This is only a layman speaking. You mentioned a couple of times. That's all. I think you have a right to voice and speak as much as anybody else and so on. Yeah. And this, we are all beginners. You know,
yeah,
that's the point that I...
Well, I guess maybe you're right.
It's like women who say on the radio, I'm only a housewife.
I guess you're right. Yeah.
I don't work.
You're right. And I shouldn't minimize that. Now,
I really think that stems from the idea that there was some inherent intrinsic value through ordination that was given, which raised up to some level those who were otherwise on a lower level of status with God or status with the state or whatever else it is.
Well, I'll tell you where it emanates from, and you're partially right. It emanates from the fact that I've been a lay priest, had a license to preach in a Methodist church for about 8 years now. and I guess I've preached about four times, and I detect a real negative attitude on the part of the professional clergy with respect to my occupying a pulpit, and I know it's there, I can't deny it, but I can't do much about it, it's there. I don't feel as though it's entirely right, but I hope this Holden Village thing is going to give me an opportunity to do that I never received from my Methodist church, and I don't want to preach salvation, that isn't it. I would like to preach participation, exposure, the search for the truth, unity among all people in all faiths, remove the barriers that separate this denomination from that denomination, realizing that Christ Jesus is the foundation stone for each. I even like to go further than that. I like to unite the pagan in some way, because he's a moral man now. His liturgies and dogmas don't mean a thing to me, but they have a moral thing going for themselves. They're so dedicated, they'll set fire to themselves, literally, and all they lack to make their religion right is Christ Jesus, as far as I'm concerned. And if they'll put this missing ingredient in there, then the Christian family has become a big family and a good family. But I sure don't like to see some guy look down his nose at me because I don't belong to his church or his synod. Because he's got the same Christ that I got, and that makes us one.
How about Red River, Montana? You ready to go?
Red River?
We were just joking about that before. So many vacancies.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I went to the district superintendent of the Central Park Methodist Church, where the headquarter office is. Oh, I came out of the male clinic with a real bad condition. I went in there with a real bad condition, and they didn't find the answer. And I talked to the Lord, of course, about this a lot. And I didn't bargain with him exactly, but I said I want to do more because I was a miserable individual. And I had an almost miraculous recovery in about 3 days, and I felt a moral responsibility to get up and do something. So I went to the district superintendent and I said, listen, I don't care what kind of church you give me. You give me a skid row, but get me something to do. It can be black as the ace of spades, but...
They don't know what that is, ace of spades.
But... I heard Carol mention this poker hand. But I haven't heard a word, you know. So I'm going to push this Holden Village thing. I think it's great.
Olaf, did you raise your hand?
No.
Anybody else?
You spoke of reading our own personalities into Jesus. Before I went to the seminary, I was in the Air Force, and I worked as a pharmacist. We had in our hospital about 6 or 8 doctors, but one of them was quite a drinker. We could, in the pharmacy, we could always tell when he'd been to a party, because his cure for his own hangovers was an ounce of Ampogel and a dose of phenobarbital and belladonna. And on the days when he had a hangover, everyone who came to him came to us with a prescription for Ampogel and belladonna. He seemed to have if it's good enough for me. And we had people tell us he didn't even let him sit down and tell him what was wrong. He just wrote the prescription. I've thought of this sometimes. How often maybe I prescribe what fits me and don't listen long enough to diagnose.
There's a painting in New York Library. It's a very fine painting of the great men who made American history.
Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, and there's one man you can't recognize, and it's the artist himself. He painted his own picture in the whole business. And they've kept that painting primarily for that reason. It's not a great painting, but all these great men there, including this one. Of course, Phillips Brooks said preaching is truth through personality. Undeniably, our personality plays an important role. And because of it, certain people are drawn to us where they might not be drawn somewhere else. This we recognize. But that's not letting it get in the way.
You know, I think Herb's real calling is going around boosting preachers' morale.
You ought to be paid pretty high for that.
I'll do anything. Even that. Even that. Your morale boosted.
You say, you know, we don't?
Do you?
Yeah, for sure.
You heard the fellow that went to heaven, and St. Peter says, I can't find your name. And the fellow says, well, I think I should be here. Go and look again. So he looked again, and he said, no, don't find your name. He said, look again. He said, once more. So Peter came to St. Peter. Yes, he said, we do find your name, but you're here 10 years too soon. He said, who's your doctor? That's a morale booster for doctors.
What kind of file do you have on everything, Shorty, as a pastor at this point? I was just interested in, I realized you were concentrating on preaching here this week here now, but what type of, how do you go about clippings and so forth to this?
When I read a book, I like this book here that I have, your empty pulpit, I will write in the front of it notations, pages, and after it I'll put I, illustration, Q, quote, W means put it all in the notebook. I throw this in my hopper, and the secretary then goes through it and puts it in my notebook. I have four huge notebooks, and the first notebook is indexed. There are about, I would say close to 75 items indexed in these four books. Like, there's one under preaching, there's one under teaching, another one under handicaps, there's another one under speech, and so on. Then, if I'm going away to speak like here, I will go through that file and I'll pull out that section of what I need. For example, this I read to you about David Livingstone. You can see it's been pretty well torn out of there, used a number of times. Now, when this gets back, she'll retype it and put it on better paper, and it gets back into the notebook again. She sees to it that gets back into my notebook. Same, here's another one I had with me. They get pretty badly handled sometimes. And this, she'll retype, fix up, and put back into the notebook. She will come and discuss with me where it should be placed in the notebook. Should this be under preachers? Should it be under problems? Will they fit together, of course? should it be in some other area? And we sort of mutually agree as to where it should be. Then, when I come back, as I say, I throw this back in the box, and she sees to it that it gets back into its rightful place. Then I have several big files in the cabinets where there are newspaper clippings and larger items, which I have. I didn't bring it down, but I showed you those clippings pertaining to ulcers of children. That's a large newspaper clipping. Then I have one here, I think I have here. I cut out a newspaper when I was in Madison, Wisconsin just recently. From the State Journal, Paul, from the Wisconsin State Journal. Doctor gives straight on dope, the use of dope, and it's a very interesting article. I haven't had a chance to pick out what I want in it, but I will check it, and then it goes to the secretary. If I want to keep the whole article, I will put the letter F, which means file it, in the cabinet. And I can go there and pull out on any subject. I have two huge filing cabinets. Now, if I'm going to use it in an immediate speech in the immediate area, I will say, put it on the card, which I can hold or read or use right there at the speech instead of like this. And then I don't keep the card. I'll probably throw the card away when I get back. The basic file is in the notebook. Then I also keep track of every speech that I've given, where I spoke, when I spoke there, to what the group was, the date and time. I have one book that pertains just to speeches, another book that pertains to sermons, and I have a check on all my texts and all the places I've preached and all the different topics that I've had. So that if I'm going to speak on preaching, I know where I spoke on this at Grand Forks or down in Miami or these different places. I can pull it all together and I'll jot it down. This leave out, this is irrelevant, this and so on. Here are suggestions or ideas I've got from you men I will put into the next time I use it. This makes quite an accumulation. And what you have to do is keep cleaning out the file as you get now then, when I prepared to come here, I pulled out all these things, laid them out on my desk, singled out the things that I wanted to take with me. Coming here now, there are a number of things I wished I'd taken along out of my files, which have increased the value, I think, of our meeting here. This is the way I operate. But I use my secretary a great deal in that, and she in turn, I'll give her a book. I say, I want you to read this. If you find anything worthwhile, let me know. My weakness is I don't like fiction. I have an awful job to get interest in fiction. I get about halfway through a book on fiction and then I can't go through with it. But some men are very good at it and they can pull illustrations, ideas out of it entirely. I even in some places, secular groups where I speak, like service clubs, I will even jot down the joke I use. The illustrations that I used at this particular point. So I can come back 10 years later and say, now the last time I was here I illustrated this, I gave this illustration, and I think that's a remarkable memory. But it isn't at all. It has nothing to do with memory. This is some of the way I do it. I used to have a big scrapbook in which I pasted things. Then I tried the card index, but I found that it didn't work out so good. This way I've got those four big notebooks. And I look through my index and it says in volume 4, page so and so, and I met it in Egyptian.
Is this just the pasted on paper in many cases?
Many cases, yes. Maybe a clipping. And one important thing I've hammered on my secretary, which she didn't realize at the beginning, the date and time from which you took this. Because something of 1950 doesn't have the same value as 1967. And I read an average of a week, and as I told you, I take 20 different magazines. And my wife is trained too. She'll say, here's an item you'd be interested in. And she'll turn to the article, like in the McCall's magazine, the article I mentioned to you. She's the one that showed that to me. Here's an item about hospitals and doctors that you'd be interested in. And even my children will send me clippings. They say, here, you know, we think you'd like this.
What are some of the magazines you found particularly helpful?
Well, in political magazines, I read The Progressive. I don't know if you're acquainted with that, any of you? Any of you know this magazine, Progressive? It's interesting.
Who puts it out?
It's put out in Madison, Wisconsin. It was started by Bob LaFalle at the turn of the century. The reason I got into it, my father was a socialist. And this is a magazine that came to our home. I like it very much. I've taken it for years. It's a very progressive, I disagree with much of it, but in politics and philosophy and life in general, and it's read by all the leading senators and politicians in Washington, it gives you an insight to what's going on in the political scene. It'll have a commentary on McCarthy, Eisenhower, Humphrey, and all of them. It's very good from that view. Atlantic Monthly is another one. I took for quite a while, but I quit it not long ago. I think it changed its character, for one thing. There are three articles in there which I didn't like. One by a Catholic priest, one by a rabbi, no, one by an atheist, and another one by supposedly a Protestant. And to me, I felt that this is what the magazine's going to become, I don't care about it anymore. Then all the Time Magazine, Newsweek, Christianity Today, Christian Century, Ramparts. Any of you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Radical Catholic magazine. And Expositor from England, or Scotland, I should say. Kind of a London. It's an interesting insight in what the preaching is going on in England, what they're thinking about over there. And they're real scholars in a good sense, not dry and dusty, but they do make the Bible real. Expositor, it's called. Expositor. And let me see, what are some of the other ones? And we have a dozen other ones that come to my desk there. The Forum, the Lutheran Forum.
We used to get the British Weekly, I know.
Yeah.
Did you get that?
No, the Manchester Guardian I took for a long time.
There was one, British Weekly.
Yes, I remember that one. Yeah. These are some of the magazines I take, and I buy quite often on the... I take the Reader's Digest, but seldom quote it, because I know everybody has read it. If I tell a joke, I never tell the one in the Reader's Digest. But I take, I'll pick up magazines like Pageant or Coronet or some of them, and find jokes in there that nobody else reads, or at least the people that don't go to church, or go to church. I read a good one the other day in there. Of the wife said to her husband, "We're going to name the daughter, our new baby daughter, Yvonne." Well, he didn't like the name at all. But he couldn't say to her that he didn't like it. So he said, "That's a wonderful name." He said, "I like it very much because the first girl I went with had that name." He said, "This will bring back many wonderful memories." The baby's name was Martha.
A positive approach. Huh?
Has anyone ever remarked to you that when you laugh, you look an awful lot like Al Rogman?
No.
Has anybody said that to you?
Is that so?
Yeah.
I've been taken for Goebel, the comedian.
Is that right?
A couple of times.
Yeah.
I said, thank you, but I don't have his money.
I know, Claire, they mistake you for Yorkland, too.
Yeah. In Minneapolis, the Central, when I first came there, reception. And they introduced me to another woman. Somebody introduced me to another woman. That woman was Mrs. Yorkland. They didn't know me, and they didn't know the other woman. Well, I said, "Where have you been all the time? I've been looking for you." It wasn't my wife at all. It was another woman that I didn't know at all.
So you've had all your parishes in the Midwest until now.
Yes.
And now here.
That's right.
Have you been able to assess any difference? Being a different congregation, yes. Talk about the locales.
Quite a difference in California. Quite a difference. First of all, very few people have deep religious roots. The very steady, dependable people I have come from the Middle West, or they are children of parents who had a fine religious background. So the strength of my church has much of it come from people who had those roots. Too many of our second generation are, like Trubud said, cut flowers. They're growing, the roots have been severed, and the blossom will go. And then I find in my congregation extremists, extremes in politics, extreme in religion, extremes in moral standards. I never had such a wide range. Some of them would look upon Goldwater as exceedingly liberal. A number of them, I'm sure, are Birchites in my congregation who would like to get me into that kind of a circle. Then there's some that would easily be classed as Unitarians, or even less. Then you have politics, you have religion, you have moral standards, where they feel that in situation ethics, taking it at its worst, so long as you don't hurt anybody in the immediate area, what difference does it make what your conduct is? These extremes I find. And large share of my people know nothing about the Lutheran Church. They don't know who Fred Schatz is.
Well, now, this is interesting. I have a very small congregation. Everything you've said now fits my very small congregation.
Is that so?
Sure.
Is that so?
I've never had a church in the Midwest, and this is not typical back there?
No. It's getting to be more typical. I should correct that slightly. I was in Madison, Wisconsin, as I mentioned about a month ago, and spoke to the Morticians Convention. And afterwards, I met with Eifert. He has a large Lutheran church there across the university, very able clergyman. And Pastor Borkwardt, who is head of Pastor Bethel Lutheran Church, and you belong to that church. We played golf together. And another minister, I don't recall his name. But after the game, we sat in the coffee together, and they were asking me the same thing about the church in California. And they said the same thing was happening now in that area, that there wasn't the religious depth that there used to be, and there wasn't the sense of dedication among its members. There wasn't the feeling that it was important to be in church, and that the newer members coming into the church had a feeling it's the respectable thing to belong to the church, but not necessarily for the purpose of deepening their religion. And they felt some of the things I was saying about California was also not true out there. Now, Paul, you are from there. What do you say? Would you, or maybe you haven't?
Well, maybe there's a possibility. I suppose it depends on the particular location. But in Madison, for instance, we have that large university up there, 30,000 students at this time on the campus. And a lot of the graduate students, people who are working on a doctor or whatever it may be, belong to Bethel or maybe to area churches in a particular area around there. And you're getting quite a cross-section of people from the east, Midwest, from the west. Mm-hmm. And this could play quite an influence, I would think, or have quite an influence in the church itself. Because a lot of your leaders, for instance, they have new company, or maybe somebody just coming up for 2 years of study as a member there. Mm-hmm. This maybe has some influence on it.
Eifert said he felt that we're moving into a period when the church membership is going to go down all across the country, and we're going to have, however, smaller numbers but more dedication. He said he felt that we're going to have small congregations but committed people. That we're going to have less and less of this idea of bigness and numbers and more dedication. I thought that was an interesting comment.
Somebody made a kind of survey in 3-4 ways in the Seattle area out of some 42 congregations of the ALC in the area. He has a rather small mission church, a very able man. In the past year, both attendance and membership has gone down in the Seattle area, including the suburban areas. Mm-hmm. Two or three of the suburban churches indicated some growth, which were false, really, because in one sense, because there was less activity and attendance or whatever else in some other area, Sunday school, communion, or the identifiable areas, and so on. Strangely enough, and ours is a fairly growing area right now.
I think we're going to have much more impact on, is there a hereafter, is there another life to come? If there is no such thing as another life, then is there such a thing as right and wrong? After all, if, as one man in his 40s said to me, I don't believe there's a hereafter, what I'm going to get is what I have to be now. And oftentimes, I suspect we ministers even encourage that idea. When a person dies, we say, isn't it too bad?
Sometimes it is.
Well, in the sense it is a youth and all that's involved here. But we're not thinking of here, we're thinking about that fellow, he died.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking about sometimes.
Yeah.
It is.
It's, I think, 12:30.
Okay.
We might eat today.
Is a warm-hearted Christian man, a personal friend of the historian Toynbee and many others. It's a small book, but a great deal in it. Here's a book called In Search of Myself. Any of you read this one? Quite a book, isn't it? By Davies, he has since passed away. He was a minister in England. who came from a very conservative family, studied for the ministry, and while at school changed his theological outlook, decided to become a Congregationalist minister, and from that he shifted to becoming a leader in the political arena. He got turned on to politics, and he became quite a leader in the political area. Although he never did get enough money to make much of a living, his family had great difficulty, and then his theology began to get pretty shaky, and he leaned strongly towards communism. Then one day he began to take a long look at his life, and he felt it had been absolutely waste. He walked out into the sea to commit suicide. And as he did, the water began to come over him. He began to say, "My Lord, what am I doing?" And he went up on the beach, laid out, stretched himself out, and began to think. And as a result of it, he went back into the ministry and became a leader in the Anglican Church. It's a well-written book. It was published after his death, In Search of Myself. And Minister, is a good book for you to read. Is The Human Problems of the Ministry. The Human Problems of the Ministry. It's a very good book, and it wouldn't hurt laity to read it also, because it shows what we ministers oftentimes have to face. Problems with people, the problems in our own home, difficulty of being understood, and difficulty with ourselves, a human problem of the ministry. This is by a Methodist minister named Walker. He lives in Pasadena, California. He's also written the book, The Enemy in the Pew, which is an excellent book. One of the ministers was telling me this little humorous story the other day. Woman came to call Mrs. Olson, we'll call her name to be safe. No, that wouldn't do any good around here. Mrs. Johnson. Any Johnsons? Mrs. Johnson was quite a talker and a pest to the minister. She'd been hanging around there, and she said goodbye to the minister, and as she stopped down in the hallway to talk to the minister's wife, was talking down there with her. And the minister upstairs yelled down, not hearing the conversation, he yelled down, "Is that the gossipy pest of a woman still here?" The wife very tactfully said, "No, she's gone, but Mrs. Johnson is here." That's a well, good training in the minister's office. And The Young Minister is an interesting book for a young minister by John Wilder. And another good book is Karl Marx and God, just published. I have it someplace. I think I left it upstairs. It's showing how communism doesn't stay put. We're always talking about fighting communism and forgetting that it isn't the same today as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago. If anything, it's moving towards our own, shall we call it, capitalistic system or free enterprise. Many ways in which they are similar to us. They used to have where there were no incentives in labor, but they do have them now. No freedom at all, but it's quite different. I was in Russia in 1937, traveled about 3,000 miles in Russia, visited hospitals, factories, playgrounds, University of Moscow, talked to the students. It was quite an interesting trip. The place was really quite primitive. It's hard for you to imagine how primitive the country was. It came out of the rule of the Tsar, and these people were backward. In the days of the Tsar, 90% of them couldn't read or write. Today, of course, the country is quite literate. It was interesting. See, they played volleyball. That was their main sport, volleyball. And it came into the country through Latvia, through the YMCAs. The YMCAs brought in there. So there's one little Christian influence. I remember one of their leaders quoted to us, he said, "Our philosophy is he that doth not work shall not eat." He said, Karl Marx made that statement. We said he did not. He said he certainly did. Then one of the men showed him where it was in the New Testament. He just wouldn't believe it. He figured that the New Testament had copied it from Karl Marx.
Who's the author of that show? Karl Marx and God.
I got it. I'll show it to you. I think the name of the man is Miller, but I'm not sure. But I'll bring the book down tomorrow. I'm reading it myself at the moment. You're familiar with Paul Tillich, Christianity and the Encounter of the World Religions. I'm not a follower of Paul Tillich. I'm not intelligent enough to be a follower. And I do not say that with a false gesture of humility, but I've heard him lecture, and I really had difficulty knowing where I was at when I went out the door. You're familiar with the Noise of Solemn Assemblies by Peter Berger, which is quite a challenge to the minister. A rather old book, Positive Preaching in the Modern Mind by P.T. Forsyth. I'm sure you all enjoyed the book by Hans Kuhn, The Council, Reform, and Reunion. Stimulating book by this man, Hans Kuhn, who has preached to and lectured to the Lutherans at Heidelberg University. Came to the lectures in a sweatshirt. Very warm. He was the leader under Pope John in the area of theology. But you can read that book. Anyone can read it and get a great deal of feeling. And you have a certain joy in reading it. And that was my reaction anyhow. The emphasis upon Christ and the feeling that they had much to learn, and it makes one go back to his own church and feeling as something there. Dying We Live is another good book. The Pilgrimage of the Western Man by Stringfellow Barr. I found that it's an older book, 10, 15 years ago. But he shows the history of man and the use of force. He points out how once upon a time the great nations like Portugal, Italy, France, Germany, England, and all of them relied on force when they got to the top of the heap and then went down. They took to the sword and perished by the sword. A strange book is called Your Child and God by Robbie Trent, showing the treatment of children down through the ages. Japan's Religious Ferment. Things are really taking place in Japan. Amazing interest in the Christian religion, but not in the Christian church. And the strong influence of the Christian religion on other religions is shown. Buddhism, which is a pessimistic religion, I visited one of their leading temples in Tokyo, spent a day there, a tremendous temple, 35,000 people in it. And the parking lot is huge. They have a dozen policemen. They're regulating the traffic to come in there. It's a regular day. They're a tremendous restaurant. And all by volunteer help. They have a song, Buddha Loves Me, that I know. Which you see the Christian influence. And many of their social reforms, they have schools, they have hospitals, they have many of the ideas of the Christian religion they've incorporated into the Buddha religion. We've strongly influenced them. If you're in the field of education, I recommend very highly a book called Education and the Common Good by Professor Phoenix. He is a professor at Columbia University. And he brings out four points in the purpose of education, which I thought was exceptional, if I can remember them. Creativity, intelligence, conscience, and reverence. Those are the four basic, those were the four foundations of education, he says. Without these, education just becomes mumbo jumbo. It's very good.
I'm reading those again.
That is Education and the Common Good, Professor Phoenix at Columbia University. I hate to admit it, but he was once a professor at Carleton College. Those of you from St. Olaf catch my little side jab there. Carleton, you know, is across the way from St. Olaf College, and all of us used to be quite competition. We hated to admit in those days that anything good came out of it. Nazareth. And I'm reading the life of Martin Luther now by Todd, Professor Todd, a Catholic historian. A very sympathetic study, and it doesn't hurt you to see Luther somewhat. They respect him, highly regard him, but feel that his method was wrong, though his ideas were in many, in most instances, correct. An old book that I read every Lent that lays the foundation for my Lenten services is The Trial and Death of Jesus by Stalker. I've never read a book that brings that period out so dramatically and the characters so real and has developed my imagination in preaching as much as this single book, Trial and Death of Jesus by Stalker. There are many, many books on making and preaching sermons. I always like McCracken on the making of the sermon. He's got a real Scotch brogue, if you've ever heard them preach. And quite an unusual preacher. He succeeded Fosdick. If you delight in interesting history, those gay Middle Ages, and they weren't quite so gay, which shows that the ignorance, superstition, the fear, and dread of people. Another good book is Magic, Myth, and Medicine by Dr. Atkinson. We sometimes think religion today is offbeat, but when you read in there the terrible things tolerated, promoted, encouraged by religion, and those of you who saw this film tonight on Let My People Go or have seen it before, you can find in this book, written by a doctor, sanctioning much of this approach to the Jew. It's a terrible thing. It tells of a community burning to death, a mother of twins, because she called in a midwife to relieve her of some of the agony of giving birth to the twins. The church and the community sanctioned, approved it, and voted it, and burned it at the stake. And another instance of Germany, of a doctor being burned at the stake because of his convictions of helping the needy people. Well, if you like enjoyable reading, delightful reading to kill time, read the book Scandalous Scamps. I take that around when I found somebody that I'm calling mine and my parishioners is too serious in religion. And they get too pious. I haven't read this book just for sheer entertainment. It's actually fact, but it shows how some people, by exceeding great cleverness, have amassed fortunes, playing on the cupidity, the stupidity, and the readiness to believe most anything on the part of people. Selling pills that you could put into your gasoline tank or your tank filled with water that would turn it into power. Henry Ford was a sucker on that one. But the best one is a woman in Cleveland, wife of a dentist, who one day she liked to live pretty high, wide, and handsome, but her husband didn't make enough, so she thought of this idea. She went to her lawyer and said, I want you to go to New York with me. And he went to New York with her. She said, I'll pay all the charges and expenses, so you come along. So he went to New York, and they drove up to the mansion of Andrew Carnegie, the great financier and steel magnate, multi-millionaire. Andrew Carnegie was always a bachelor. And she went in and she said, you wait here in the carriage, I'll be out in about a half hour. And then she came out holding some bundles that she'd kept concealed under clothes when she went in. She came out and she showed some rather official documents. Now she said, I'm going to tell you why I brought you along with me. I am the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. He has promised to take care of me all my life if I do not disclose my identity to him or to anyone. But I have to have some evidence and proof. He has given me these securities, and he does send me sums of money, but he's given me these securities valued at least for $250,000. And I am going to deposit them in the bank in Cleveland. All I want is your evidence that I was here to see Andrew Carnegie. Well, the lawyer swallowed it. And she went back to the bank, deposited in the bank, and she said to the bankers, now if you have any question about these securities I have here as collateral for money, you speak to my attorney, he will tell you that they are dependable. As a result of it, she borrowed from the bank up to, $500,000. She'd pay back a little, and she borrowed from Oberlin University. Oberlin University gave her $25,000. She bought up into the thousands of dollars. Took her whole bridge club to Europe on a trip, for example. And she lived a glorious time. Banks gave her money, and of course everybody whispered around town the secret. She's a daughter. Andrew Carnegie, just what she wanted. And her husband, apparently quite a simpleton. It apparently wasn't a Norwegian. And I'll not say what it was, but be too dangerous. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, he just paid no attention to it. She told him, I'm playing the stock market. And I have pretty good luck in playing the stock market. So he swallowed that. As the result of it, however, a number of people committed suicide. Finally, she was exposed and put in prison. Her story of her background, her childhood, to his interest, she came from Canada and of a very poor family, but she wanted to live a high, wide, handsome life, and she started right off as a bat as a child and then fled to Cleveland. But this is just one of the numerous stories in this book, Scandalous Scamps. So if you can't sleep at night, just read this. I find it immensely entertaining to read. Well, those are just some books that I just threw out before I... There are others, too. I didn't really intend to mention them. Now, we have been talking about the world in which we live and how we ministers are called upon to face it and the problems which we face in the changing times. One of the problems which we are facing, which I see as I mingle with other ministers, is what should enter into the pulpit in your preaching? How much should you be concerned about civil rights in your preaching? How much should you be concerned about the racial inequality? How much should you be concerned about Vietnam in your pulpit, I'm speaking now? How much should we say about the European situation? What should we bring into the pulpit? I wished I'd brought along a clipping which was published, and I mentioned it to you earlier, but I repeat it again. A clipping that was published in the Minneapolis Star just about a month ago. The man who wrote it, I know very well personally, and he sent a copy of it and wanted my reaction to it. In there he tells about visiting the churches in Minneapolis, Lutheran, Methodist, Baptist, Congregation, and so on. And every one he went away discouraged and disgusted, because they were either spending the sermon on Martin Luther King and his assassination, or they were discussing race problems, Vietnam situation. One was proud of the fact that he'd been arrested in a civil rights disturbance, and he said he wondered whether the ministers themselves didn't need the grace of God. Now, maybe he's wrong. Maybe we churches have been negligent. Maybe if the churches had been a little wider awake in the days of Hitler, it would have been a totally different situation. Why weren't the churches aware of what was taking place? Why didn't the churches speak up? Some of you may have seen the play, The Deputy. Any of you seen it? It's quite a play, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Tremendous a criticism of the Pope that he was silent during that time when he should have spoken up. It's a terrific. Hoghuth, the writer of it, claims to be able to substantiate everything that he said. And then there's another book by Professor Zahn of Loyola University called Hitler, The Catholics and Hitler's War, and The Catholic and Hitler's Wars. And he does take his church to task and says that they did not come to the support of the people who are or come to the support of people seeking to protect the Jew. I was in Germany in 1937, 39. I was also 1929. But I shall not soon forget some of the sights that I saw. I saw a Jewish boy beat up in the park and people and police standing laughing. Went to the Jewish synagogue, visited with a couple of Jewish rabbis, magnificent Jewish synagogue. It was burnt down a week later on. To see them walking around the streets with this emblem on them that they were Jews, and to see the sadness with which they walked around, it's quite a sight. We met in a private room with Louis Lochner, who later on received the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the conditions in Germany. He told us of some of the conditions that existed, and he said, this room, fortunately, I believe, and I cannot all is guaranteed, but nothing I say here can go outside of this room. And I shall deny anything that I say to you. If tomorrow you quote me, he said, I will ridicule it and say I never said it. In order that I can stay here in Germany, and in order that I can report, I must do this. But I'm telling you that the churches are not aware of what's taking place, and that the Catholic Church is probably one of the sources of anti-Semitism in Germany. These are some of the things that you ran across in Germany. There's quite a sight to behold. I visited and heard Martin Niemöller preach the sermon that caused him to be thrown into prison. Nazi spies are down the front. A couple of days later, we were in his home, and he said to us outside in the lawn, don't talk in that room up there where the telephone is. I'm sure that it has been tapped, and every bit of conversation will be stated there. In that room, we had Hans Lilly, de Villiers, and Martin Niemöller, who spoke to us about the conditions existing in Germany and their struggle and fight to keep the Christian faith alive. I remember Martin Niemöller, who said to us, the church will go down in ashes, but out of it will rise a better church. As you know, he defied Hitler and shook his finger at him and said, God is my fear, not you. It was only because of the financier under Hitler, Schacht, who made it possible for Niemöller to stay alive. He stayed for a number of years in prison. And Hans Lilly, if you know him, he can tell you some of the things that he went through. Where was the church? What was the matter with our preaching? I heard sermons in Germany, standard type of sermons, but somehow the church seemed to be part of the government. Hitler himself said, the church is rotten. I could topple it over with a push of my hand. I saw newspapers. I do not read German, but I saw newspapers which had in it, died in the faith of Adolf Hitler. And I saw quite a few quotations of men saying, Jesus Christ was great, but Adolf Hitler is greater. I saw thousands and thousands of soldiers saluting and saying, Heil Hitler. It is a strange experience to go through, to see this nation going like this and going through this experience. And to know how the soul of Germany was being lost. We saw in this film the persecution of the Jew. I think of the terrible things that were taking place in the medical practice. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which I'm sure by William Shire. In there he tells of some of the horrible practices of the doctors and making reports at medical conventions, how they'd experimented on people to see how long they could live in frozen water. Or how they'd operated on people to see what effect these different types of operations have, or injecting certain things into their system to see the results of it. The cold, inhumane treatment of their fellow men. It's unbelievable that man can become such a monster. What's wrong with the church? It's Lutheran Germany and Lutheran Catholic Germany. Can we get into the same situation in our own country? Or, as some of these friends of mine say, if we don't get this into the pulpit and preach these things in the pulpit, we'll go down just like Germany and possibly even, as George Orwell said in his book 1984, we'll eventually have the dictator. Well, what do you think? I have tried to hold the position myself as a minister, and I tell you mine, that the pulpit is not the place for these things. I've said it is my duty to quicken the conscience and disturb the consciences of the people in the pew, but that they themselves, businessmen, social workers, teachers, shall be leaders in these particular areas. It is my duty to tell the merchant he must be honest in his price of sugar, but I cannot tell him what the price is. He must, from his own experience, do it. I must trouble his conscience enough so he'll want better schools, more justice, greater equality. But sometimes my conscience troubles me that I haven't gone far enough in it. And I know in talking with Frederick Schutz, the president of our church, that he is disturbed and feels that the church somehow has been negligent in this particular area. Well, I leave it at this point now. I want your reaction. What do you think?
I suppose it's very easy to use this idea, to be honest about it, and yet to use it as a means to hide. I am preaching the gospel, therefore, to spare any criticism, any ostracism of those who may believe quite differently within the congregation or your own fellows. This is a real danger.
I have a peculiar experience right where I am. Right next to me is a Presbyterian church. The other side of me is a Mormon church. The Presbyterian minister is strongly involved both in feeling and action in the colored problem in the Watts area and other areas. He's been spent time in Africa last summer. He preaches about it, speaks about it. It has disturbed and troubled his people. He's at a congregation of some of the leading people of Westchester. And I'm in the uncomfortable position that a number of them have been coming to my church. I know that some of these men very well. Don Roberts, a Presbyterian minister, I go over and visit with him. He and I are very good friends. And we have been debating this back and forth. What should be the attitude of it? He's gone so far that he's put in petitions in his church for the members to sign on particular issues before the court and law and so on, wanting his people to sign the Mumford Act of the state. He wants it repealed. Housing, free housing and so on. These are things which he's pushing his people on. I tell him, I can't take your viewpoint. I said, I don't believe it can be done. I don't believe this is going to be the solution. Then some of the top real estate men and the leading real estate men in that whole area and most of California is one of the finest members I have in my church. And he is quite against any racial equality. Well, it puts me in a tough spot. By the way, Abernathy spoke to our district convention in Los Angeles recently. It was really quite interesting. I happened to be on the program right after him, which is another interesting thing. We were debating entering the National Council of Churches. I am for it. And there were many more against it. But what is amusing to me, it seemed to be, that after Abernathy spoke to us, the crowd, the ministers and everyone stood and applauded for about 5 minutes. And gave him tremendous ovation when he went out. And I said to the people present, I rather suspect, I said, that this ovation is our way of dismissing him and all that he stands for. It gives us a feeling of satisfaction that we've praised him and now we'll go ahead and do as we please. Well, that may be beside the point. What do you men feel about it in your particular area?
This may be beside the point, but it has disturbed me that somehow that in our metropolitan areas that I'm acquainted with, I speak particularly of Seattle, that it's sort of taken for granted by the press and the media of communication that the Lutheran Church doesn't have much to say or much concern with any of these grave social issues. So in your newspapers, when there's any issue that in which the community is involved, and many times very serious, the people that are quoted are the leaders in the Congregational Church, the Methodists, Presbyterians, Roman Catholics, and even Jews. But seldom do you ever find any quote from any Lutheran voice. We have one or two exceptions in Seattle, and yet we are the largest Protestant group in the entire metropolitan area. And I asked one not so long ago, whom I know very, very well, and I thought it was a shock to me in a way, and yet I sort of anticipated he was after the lines, and Seattle men would know who he was. I wouldn't want to repeat his name because it was rather incompetent. Well, he said, it seems to me, he said, as far as I know, he said, we have contacted
some time, a couple, three, but they never have anything to say. He said, we just assume sort of that there is something that your church doesn't get too involved in. And I think they're extremes. I think that our Protestant churches sometimes go to the extreme in one direction. And this can certainly is not our business. But on the other hand, it certainly seems to me that as strong as the Lutheran constituency is in numbers in an area like Seattle, that we ought to have some Lutheran voice, some kind of speaking to the community that we are involved with, and that we are in the battle too in this whole race problem. Now our pastors don't feel that way. I came to them with a little request for some money for scholarships for the central area for a Negro program, and I was proud of our Lutheran pastors. It was tremendous the way they responded. Within just a few minutes, we had raised $300 for scholarships to help out these people. But as far as what is it? Now, I think Minneapolis is different. You certainly there, the Lutheran Church is a voice, a strong voice. But is it because we don't get involved enough in our preaching and in our participation, maybe in community? Maybe there's where it should be, on committees, on involvement in this kind of a thing.
It raises a question to me. Does the church, and I've really struggled with this, does the church merely accept society, I mean, as it's built, and then move from there? Or does the church have some things in terms of its understanding of man that demands that it criticize structure of society itself? It is the structure of the suburbs that are based upon some really false ideas about man that draw lines at this particular spot and make my child have the best kind of education from an academic standpoint, but he's quite impoverished from some other viewpoints because he's not exposed to other races and other people. Dave Price got up a week ago when we had our thing on Project Summer Hope and said, in the inner city school, or out in the suburbs, 2 out of 30 kids need a little help to get on the road when they're in kindergarten. Or no, 2 out of 20. And in the inner city school, it's 12 out of 20. 12 kids out of 20 that just don't have a chance, you know. And does the church just, kind of accept that and preach the law and the gospel and sort of, or does the church say there's something demonic, about the structure of society? It has to be changed, And it seems to me that this has to be done. Now, Pastor Barty, Pastor Pina Outreach, I don't know whether it's going to blow the congregation apart or not, but the pastors of the church have decided that we're willing to have him spend time in this area. We'll do the housekeeping and support him. And he has gone out. He took 8 points. He decided after Martin Luther King died, I think that was the turning point, that it wasn't even enough to try to draw consensus. If a man was going to try to change the structure, he had to find, maybe do it himself, or find one other person and move. And then let the people divide and let them talk, let them discuss. They took 8 points to the city council. They met with the city council, St. Louis Park, and they were points to do with equal opportunity employment, sensitivity training for the police department, and on down the line. Eight rather strong points. And they met with the council. There were more people out of that meeting than had ever been before. Pastor Barty presented the 8 points. They talked about them for two
2 hours. They passed 7 of them and said, we're going to act on them now. And this, and the 8th one was on banks loaning to the inner city, and they turned that one over for study and a report next meeting. Then he went out to the school board meeting the next last week with similar points on education. Now, he raised the question, it's a good question, I think, about what his role is. He feels that the role of the church is, and the role of the pastor, is to raise the questions, stir the conscience. And if people say, well, you don't know, he says, that's right. That's your job. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the city councilman's job, it's the banker's job to figure out how. But it's the church's job to raise the questions, stir the conscience. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yes?
I rather agree with you on the using the pulpit, you know, as a base of attack on the community, because I feel the Christian message, proclamation, can suffer. But now in Portland, we have a very unique situation under Paul Schulze, who was a Lutheran clergyman. The Church Community Action Program was started, and there's 8 groups now. And in each locale, the churches are together, and they support their own programs, serving the needs in their own very immediate area. And if congregations can back up programs like this, which involve not just money, or not just marches on Washington or something else, but very constructive service, a lot more, I think, can be done in a positive way. We have 8 members now out of Schulze's Model City program there in Portland, 8 of our own members that teach classes to illiterate adults downright in the inner city area. So the talents of people in the suburbs are being invested on the needs in the inner city. And then Portland has this summer crisis program. It's a youth recreational program. The churches are raising $50,000 for that just for the summer months. But it's one community where all the churches have been very active. I mean, the majority of churches, and the majority of Lutheran churches, very active in solving some of the immediate problems. And as a result of that, the churches in Portland say a great deal to the community, from the mayor on down, and everyone in the community listens because they know the job is getting done. Doesn't matter whether it's a one-to-one program between high school students, potential dropouts, and college students. That happens to be one of our area programs. And a college student will adopt one of these potential dropouts through the high school. And we're driving people to hospitals for medical checkups. It happens to be way on the other side of town, the county hospital. There's a lot of service that can be done very quietly, and yet very effectively, very personally. And I don't see where just standing up on a pulpit, and shouting at the rooftop really does very much. It may set up a lot of antagonism, and unless you back up everything very, with all information and could present both sides, I think a lot of seminars, a lot of forums could go on in our churches where this could be discussed much more fruitfully, where you have a give and take situation than in the pulpit.
Yeah.
Reference can be made, but I don't think big, broad policies should come from the pulpit.
Do you think in your clubs, brotherhood, and women's groups, you could discuss it?
Yes. Sure.
This is what I've been doing.
Where we get the financial support for a lot of these things.
I think in your adult classes provides, any type of your adult class provides a good forum for this too.
But we have a seminar coming up on June the 11th where we have specifically invited Black Power representatives, because our people don't know this side and have very little feeling for this movement, and they're going to come out and share it with us, and they'll get the feedback too, which I'm sure they're familiar with. But our people can grow in this more fruitfully than just big statements coming from the pulpit.
You have a day school?
No, they're the midweek schools.
Do any of you have day schools? I am a day school, 6th grade. We take colored children now. Mm-hmm. And a man came to me and said, if you'll announce that you'll not have any colored children you'll increase your attendance and increase your income.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I said, we aren't making an announcement that we take them or don't take them. We just take good pupils that fit, and we don't pay attention to the color of their skin. If the colored boy isn't up to snuff, he can't get in. But we have six now, I guess, six colored children, and they're very good. And they're Baptist, they're no Lutherans, any of them. One is the son, the girl is the daughter of the Baptist minister in the territory, not far away. But he wants them in our school. So they come in and out of our office, and we have colored people in our audience every once in a while. And when I see a colored woman come in to sit down, I immediately go and pick one of my women. I said, you please go and sit next to her and explain some parts of their service. We make no fuss, no commotion about it. It is a normal thing.
Isn't this whole problem of the separation of the sacred and the secular and the impossibility of doing this and all of our, our Board of Research and Social Action has attempted to try to keep us a little bit informed as to what's going on, but we're in a real dilemma, was explained over here, of just where does it fit in? And Lutheran Church certainly hasn't been a leader in this area whatsoever. I think of the Episcopalian Convention in Seattle just recently, in which they voted several millions of dollars for direct involvement at this point. Another church that up until a few years ago has had very little to say, but now has involved themselves. And we've always left this to the Methodists and others before to say something. And I think we really need to struggle with this.
I'd like to take the side of the other side. I belong to the Rotary Club and have in different cities. I would say 95% of my Rotarians would be opposed to integration. And, they will give lip service to it. But come down to brass tacks, as I was sitting next to one of the men who owns a number of apartment houses. He said, I used to own a nice dwelling over, and he told me the section where he lived. And he said, I decided to be tolerant, and colored people moved in. I said, I'm going to stick it out, he said, and I stayed there. But pretty soon my children began to be affected by it. The school in the area began to go downhill. I noticed my kids weren't learning. And I didn't want to ship them out of the community. I didn't know quite what to do. He said the school was not a good school. The children were being pulled down by the level of the colored children. And he said, I stuck it out until it was about 75% colored. And now he said, I've moved. I live over near your church, he said. But he said, I wanted to be tolerant, but I just couldn't. While we were having all this commotion in our hotel there, at the International Hotel in Los Angeles, they were putting up a big sign there for the evening for something rather. And a communion service, I think it was that evening. And should remember it, I had charge of it. But anyhow, these men, I went up to speak to them about the sign. They didn't answer me. And a man called me over. He said, they're all Mexicans. They don't understand a word you're saying. But they said to sit down. And he said, who are you? Well, I said, I'm interested in the service here tonight. But I said, those Mexicans are good workers, aren't they? Yes, he said, we had all colored workers up until a few years ago. Everyone around here was colored. We wanted to be fair, but he said they were no good. He said they'd slough off, couldn't find them when he wanted. They were lazy, careless, some of them dishonest. He said, these people are three times as good. They will pitch in, work. He said, this is our situation. Now, how are you going to answer that? Then there's another one. Man said to me, I have an apartment house in an area that was worth $250,000. I couldn't sell it for $75,000 now. Now it's awful easy for us to say, be tolerant, be fair, be just, be Christian. I wonder how we'd act if we lost that amount of money. That's another side of it.
Seems to me that the answer to that is not so hard to find. I mean, in terms of you take the Jewish people, or the Norwegian people, and it's the most common thing said is You know, I worked through the Depression, you hear people say. All of our neighbors have said that to my wife, the women, you know. We worked through the Depression. And they did. And then the Negroes can too. Let them work through. But they don't remember that they had pride. And the Jews, they had a national pride. They had a sense of identity, you know, that it seems to me could carry them through just about anything. But where has the Negro had that? Where in history has he ever had a dream that he had a chance? A ghost of a chance. And another thing someone pointed out to me recently is, you know, sure, my dad made it through the Depression, but even at that time, we were stealing from the colored people. Then, what chance did they have then, back in the 1930s? As we were building, as the Norwegians in North Minnesota or in the United States, the white people were building themselves up. They were doing it by stamping on the Negro's head, weren't they? What chance did they have?
Well, how do you get that?
I don't.
What I mean
there's
is
no Negroes
because
there,
of the ghetto, because sure. of the precisely there were no, because they weren't there.
Yeah, there were no
because
Negroes
because they were in the ghetto. That's why the ghetto, like that film tonight.
In what ghetto?
That's why they were localized in the South on on crummy old farms with
well,
some guys sucking the life out of them.
How would that make a difference with those Norwegian attitudes who were grubbing out of the soil?
What I'm saying is that the whole American economy at that time, these people were never, even at that time, given any kind of a chance. What I mean to say is we were stealing from them even back then, even in those days. As Americans, as citizens, we had a responsibility to them. Even if we lived up in northern Minnesota.
That riot control commission report there, I think that chapter on the history of the American Negro was one of the most enlightening things, and I was absolutely ashamed to read that.
Right.
I couldn't believe that that happened in the United States of America. I had history back in, history and civics back in as a senior in high school, but I was really foreign to that when I read that. I just couldn't believe that that was a part of our history. I was ashamed to call myself an American, really.
The Norwegians or the Germans or Swedes all came over with a dream. The Negro came over with nothing and was not given, and didn't come over on his own free will, and was, you know, subject to slavery. So there really is no parallel between his ethnic culture in America and any other. We treated the Indian almost as badly, and are almost as prejudiced toward the Indian as we are toward the Negro, and neither fare very well. And the only thing that's going to solve the Negro's problem eventually will be education, where he can compete with the rest of American society, and that takes a generation. It isn't going to happen overnight, but it's awfully hard. I know in Portland there we have several Negro families in the neighborhood, and it's $35,000-$40,000 homes on the average, and they're not there, you know, under anybody's gumption except their own, but they don't want 75% of the neighborhood to become Negro. They simply want to disperse, just as any other ethnic group has a right to disperse, because they know themselves what happens when all the Negroes, there is prejudice against the poor Negro as the white who is threatened economically. Well, sure, but they just simply want to disperse, and they can't because of their low educational, you know, level, and will stay there until they aren't educated. And I think, like with the schools, all our local school boards should make sure that the best schools in the city are given to these Negro children who don't have the advantages of the home that the white community has, where a father is there, for example. And so we maybe have to get our most imaginative teachers and pay them double if necessary to teach in these areas, and give them an education without equal, so that the odds that are working against them will more or less balance out until the thing solves itself.
Yes, I
feel we're going to be too late.
unless we're going to start recognizing the dumb Negro, that the dumb Negro has something to say to the educated person also, that the educated person is going to go down there and ask the Negro question, his point of view. If the Negro doesn't have anything to say to us, to the educated man, then I think we're going to be too late if we're going to wait to educate him.
This is
a good point. I mean, this is in terms of time on that. This is a point
she can't be seen back here. So.
Somebody, I hear a voice.
Yeah,
I hear a voice.
I just was asking, but I felt so frustrated when he said over there. Because he had, I don't know if we can wait for the registry. That's what we 2 years from now. One year, 4 years, we can have 4 more years. And what I want to know is, what can we do now as Christians? We have to get involved. Because some of the women are too long or too hot. And they're tired of waiting. And they're men, you know. I mean, they're just at the point of boiling over. I've talked to some of them. And they're not going to wait anymore. And I mean, true, education is massive. But we've got to think of something else that's not with them now. I mean, we can't solve all the problems overnight, I know, but there's, I don't know, we have to get the action now.
But you can't go into their community, and you can't. You're not accepted, your love is suspect, even if it's in the name of Jesus Christ. And the church, where the church has done this, it has erred beyond repair. We've gone in there in a very patronizing way, and painted up their streets, and then gone home.
Yeah.
Now, what Schulze did in Portland, and what he encouraged many Lutheran Christians to do, is to move into their area. I mean, there are very fine areas, you know, that instead of abandoning it, move into it, and bring your culture, your advantages, but don't come out from the suburbs and spend a weekend, and then go home, because they'll hate your guts, or bus them in or out. You know, that's problems too.
That's a ridiculous thing. We're doing it, it's being proposed in Seattle now, Garfield and Cleveland, a couple of those of busting this business.
Well, they're trying to get away from this.
And boy, I tell you, I think that's out of it.
Automatic.
Jeff said that one layperson back there have a chance?
Yes, I think so. Okay, layperson. Joan, you're layperson.
Equality, let's practice it here.
White and civil, what a measure.
I think that sometimes the white Christian or even nominal church member forgets that if, in many of the cities of our country, particularly the Midwest, let's take Gary, Indiana, which is my home, if 50% of the people in Gary are church members, and they are, and 50% of them stay exactly where they are, then you will never have 75% Negro and 25% white. Because a Negro cannot move in if a white does not move out.
Sure.
And in where my folks go to church, I live, my family lives in the 95% Negro block right now. And all of the Christians moved out. The nice honkies, we used to call them, and the Polacks next door, and the no good German Lutheran next door, and so in our block, there are 4 white folks. And the Negroes that have moved in are a very good class of Negro, or they couldn't have bought in the first place. And all of the incomes have gone down, but are now leveling off. But if all of Presbyterians and the Lutherans and the Methodists on that block had stayed and mingled, it would have been just about 50%. And I think it was a 50-50, there can be no problem in terms of lowering educational standards or any other kind of standards. Actually, the education of these Negroes on our block is far superior to the education I received, because we were in the semi-ghettos of Gary for my education, and they have demanded all kinds of things. But my major point is that if the Christians would stay, even nominal ones, right where they are, we will equalize. number.
You think this should be a topic for the pulpit? Or for discussion, or what? Getting back to the pulpit idea.
I think it should be a part for the seminar. I'm not sure that it's a part for the pulpit, except of loving and living.
Did you really follow through on this, though? On your aims on this? Because you have had quite, at least as far as Central is concerned, quite successful responses on social issues very directly. That seems to be more, it must be more than indirect. Mm-hmm. I mean, live and love everybody in a general way.
In a large church like Central, you can absorb a lot of different things that a small church can't.
Yeah.
We had colored people, we had quite a few former Jews, we had Indians, number of people, but they'd get so absorbed in there that it didn't disturb anybody particularly.
I don't think it should be indirect. I think it's a direct from the pulpit, but that it's not a beating in the pulpit.
Do you think it'll cause any backlash?
Yeah.
Boy, I know of a particular church, and the members are there. They're more anti-color than they ever were before. They didn't set their teeth like
so
that.
So are my folks, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. I was brought up to be very unprejudiced until it was.
And they've shifted. Yes, Paul?
Do you want to get back to the idea of the pulpit?
Yes, that's our.
I mean,
bring us back.
You mentioned this, getting back to the idea that. I was thinking that in our own community, Madison, I noticed that several people in our office, for instance, and I'm sure it happens in all offices, were sitting around discussing this problem, and say the Negro situation, and or just plain civil rights, you might say. And every once in a while, somebody will pipe up and say, "Well, we never hear anything from the church, and we want to hear something from most people know Bob Borger. We never hear Bob Borger really give a good sermon on it. And this is something that kind of I was throwing around my mind. Well, why doesn't the church say something from the pulpit? And if the lay people are asking this in the offices or wherever they may be working, there must be some question, there must be some idea that they want the church to stand on something.
They can dispense it pretty easily, though. You know, if I preach and I'm in kind of sour mood and I hit kind of a phony law sermon, you know, they all go out through the door praising me. And, you know, they've been beat little and that makes them happy. I wonder if there's some of that behind it.
What are the grounds, though, I'd be interested in, what is the criteria on which we leave it out? I mean, I can understand the idea of not, that beating people on the head isn't effective. That I understand. But on what basis do we leave out social issues?
Well, we don't leave them out as problems, but as solutions.
You mean opposing solutions?
Yes.
I'd like to make a comment here. The Methodist Church has got what they call a Christian outreach program in the Twin City area. They established an in-city, inner-city church, and then they've enlisted, they didn't enlist, they automatically involved all the suburban churches into the program without too much previous consultation or voting or getting congregational opinions. They just involved them, period. And as a result of this, one of the large churches downtown has got a split membership because this is a controversial subject. And as a result of this, several suburban churches have got a split congregation for the same reason. This is a subject that's as bad as Republican and Democratic. It's worse, frankly. And when you get all through stirring this mess up and nobody tries to argue the merits or the moral responsibilities on each of us as Christians in attacking the problem, But I question the advisability of the church doing anything other than try to inspire the individual Christian from the pulpit with respect to his moral responsibilities in relation to his profession of in Christ Jesus as his Savior, and then that individual can become a force in this area. But the church can't go much beyond this. If they do, they might just dilute their spiritual program so badly. After all, this is welfare. Now, if let's take a church program where they vigorously try to encourage the membership to participate in a retreat. If they're lucky, they may get a half of 1% of the male membership or the female membership to go there. This is a church program. Now, we're talking about a program involving a good deal of welfare, involving education, and involving two different colors, involving almost rebellion on the part of one, almost coercion on the part of one, violence, burning, looting, illiteracy, immorality, dope, all of these things. And we're going to tackle a problem like this and compel our membership, for example, to live alongside of one of these individuals who would resort to this kind of a tactic to accomplish an end? Look, if I do any one of those things, I want the authorities to come after me and put me, intern me. Because in our society, we attack these programs at the polls. I don't know how we're going to do it without splitting our church and diluting our program. And nobody questions
the
necessity of doing it.
If I may say so, that seems to me, you said they burn, you know.
Speaking of.
Who burns? I mean, that seems to me to be a statement, that's a generalization.
Referring to the colored race?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead. Yeah.
What I'm saying is you're suggesting that the colored race burns. And that's a prejudice statement.
There's no question about that.
A true statement.
Huh?
In fact, it's a very small percentage of the colored people that were involved in the riots. There were, according to the Kerner report, 14%ers actively trying to prevent people from burning. Their own neighbors, you know. And there were another 50% or whatever it was who did not participate at all. So isn't this just precisely the kind of thinking? A generalization swatted across a whole mass of colored people, and then you make the statement, I don't want this person living by my side. It doesn't follow.
Well, I don't mention this as, you understand, this is an incident among many others. Let me give you another example. Within the Negro family, I know a man personally by the name of Bill Shields, who was a professor at Tuskegee. And a good man, a tremendous lecturer, and a lot of ability. And academically, he was could stand alongside of any white man who was educated. And he can live alongside of me anytime. And I'd be honored to have him as a neighbor. And any of you would be. And my property wouldn't depreciate one penny. And he'd probably be one of my best neighbor. His color's got nothing to do with it. He told me, he said, Irv, he said, I live in no man's land. My own people don't accept me because I am educated. And the white people do not accept me because of my skin. Now, the point that I'm making here is this. You have a segregation among the colored people. And you have it among the Jews, and you have it among the whites. And you have it among the rich whites. We've got many, many lines in our society. It isn't just black and white.
Yeah, but then you must never make a statement. They burn.
Well, it's a...
Never. You must never say that about a race. He may say it about Joe Jones or 14% of a race, but never about a race, because that doesn't that fog up the whole thing.
Well, I'm not guilty, incidentally, of this prejudice personally against the colored people, but am I not enjoying a reputation in this regard because of white people that do have a prejudice?
You know, I want to tell you.
Or how about you?
Yeah, I got prejudice.
What do you do to hurt the colored people?
Sure, I do.
You hold them down?
Yeah, I do. I think everybody
does. Well, I don't.
Well, I think you do.
How?
Just by what you said.
Well, that's
you said
ridiculous.
They. And I think any time anybody generalizes on a race, you're holding somebody down.
Taking one word in a sentence, you understand, Bruce.
Yeah, but it's...
Making this word a mountain out of that word.
I think it is a mountain. I really do in our society, because it's what we call, what people are starting to call, racism.
Well,
I think
it
is.
You're making a real big problem out of it then,
yes.
When you get it down to words.
I am.
Olaf?
I want to tell you, I'd like to tell you a story.
Just a minute, Bruce.
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel that I should say this, because during the past 8 months, some of you know this, one of my special assignments at Seattle Community College was to work among the Negro community. Because the college happens to be the metropolitan campus, is right on the edge of the central area, and this is where 90% of the Negroes in Seattle live. And as a result, I had the opportunity, first time, I've never worked with Negroes, so I'm no kind of an authority. I've read a lot of books since, because I had to do this work. But I met, I imagine, at least 100 of the Negro leaders in Seattle, perhaps more than most of you met, and had some very fine discussions with them, got to know them, and I got a new appreciation of the Negro. Now, most of the people that I met were educated Negroes. Many of these were ministers, and if I mentioned the names, you'd know who they were. And or they were in television or with the news media or things like this. But one of the things, and they all said this, the last thing that any of us want from you white people is pity. All we want to do is to gain our self-respect, the pride of the people, the black people, that we're proud to be black, as you are proud to be white. And so I have accepted the whole idea of black power in its right way. There's a black power that's wrong, there's a black power that's right. But when the rational Christian among the Negro talks about black power, he's talking about a recognition of his race, rather his color. And that we accept the Negro on par after 100 years or more now, that he hasn't had this right to go into a restaurant, into a hotel, into a theater with the rest of us. But and so what I did, as I went around and called on these Negroes from one to another, was to listen to what they had to say. And they appreciated this, and I have a whole file on the Negro community now, and quotations and what they think and what they say and what they want. And they want a right to live. If they want to buy a house, many times they can't buy a house, and they admit this. They don't have the education, they don't have the money, but if they wanted to move into some area in Bellevue, and they did have the money, that they could go and buy a $35,000 house and live alongside a white person, a white family, and be accepted at least as a decent first-grade citizen. And these Negroes who are educated, for the most part, they are just as sensible about this whole thing as we are. They recognize all of the problems they got in their own community. Most of the Negroes coming into Seattle today are coming from Mississippi. And many of them don't know how to read, they don't know how to write, and they recognize that education is the great thing. Now, to get education, they need motivation, and this goes back generation. How do you get motivation? And so they've got their own groups. The CAMP, for example, this is the Central Area Motivation Program. And these people are ringing doorbells, going from doorbell, from house to house, trying to help Negroes, fellow Negroes, with motivation to work, to get some education. And it was with this kind of a thing that we finally got into Garfield, which has a good educational program, and now starting a program to try and reach the hardcore, and it's dealing with some success in this kind of a thing. But I feel that that it's here, not so much the pulpit, and I don't think they expect us, as far as I got from the clergymen, that we are going to get up on Sunday mornings and do like some of these guys have done and give them all kinds of problems with our people, but rather that we will be influential in the community, in serving on committees, in supporting programs that will help them to gain their dignity, or which they've never had in many cases, and so that they can feel and sense that they are accepted as first-rate citizens as well as others when they are deserving of this kind of a thing. I believe that we're putting so much emphasis, and it's wrong, on all these riots and so forth, that we forget the Negroes, Christians, who are agonizing, who are working, who are praying and giving in order that they can help their own people. And all they want, they don't want us to come in there, and they told us, they told me how they resented the white people always imposing, coming in and telling them how to do this now, how to do that, and so forth, rather than utilizing their own resources and their own people to do this work among their people where they can understand it. And there's a deep resentment, at least in Seattle, and I know this is right, because I've been told this many, many times, of all of these people that have tried and they've meant it well, and the better ones accept this if they think the thing through, but they don't like this imposing, this kind of coming in and pitting them, and a handout here and a handout there. Mm-hmm. They want an acceptance, and I think if we can do this, it seems to me that we are getting we're on the right direction, and we will get someplace. But and I also spoke up on this idea of busing, trying to force this kind of integration that they don't particularly care for. They would rather have the idea, the freedom of open housing, where they can go in and they can if they want to. But trying to, and this also, they said this, like Dr. John Adams and Sonny Buxton, who was a very influential Negro, and Carter of the YMCA and all the rest of them, that they don't expect this to happen overnight, the better ones. They realize this is a long-term program, but they feel the time is here now. And they're getting excited about it because they do can see somewhat of a dawn of a better day for their Negro people.
Joan raised her hand a long time ago.
Oh, that's right. No, go ahead.
All ladies first. Go ahead, Joan. Come on, Joan.
We want to hear it.
Joan, we want to hear it.
I would like to tell you of two very successful experiments that have been tried. One in the Watts area. Everybody's wondering what's going to happen there. I'm bold enough to predict that nothing serious will happen this summer. One of the reasons is because many little organizations have been working in through it, but our police there, we have a very good chief of police, Redding, and he's made every effort to understand them. And the police now, in both Venice and in the Watts area, instead of driving around in police cars, they walk their beats. Two policemen, a colored and a white, walk together in and out all day long, they have different ones, of course, and go in and out of the stores, greet the children, visit with the people, any problems, anything, and talk to them, help them. And so now the police are known up and down the street. Instead of a police car and a motorcycle cop going up and down the street, whom they don't know, these policemen are known, acquainted,
and are called on when there's some special problem as a friendly contact. The most successful area, I think, has been in Philadelphia, which has had a serious problem. There's a Baptist minister there by the name of Reverend Theodore Sullivan. He has tackled the problem purely from the colored viewpoint. And he has gotten some old buildings, started schools, teaching them trades to be tailors, to be cooks, and every kind of occupation, helping them in their schools. And it attracted attention so much that President Johnson sent Humphrey over there, and they've sent them sums of money to improve their schools and situation. Over 1,500 have they trained to be able to fill trades and occupations. These are two very positive areas.
The witness, I believe, had an article about a church in Washington, D.C. that tackled the problem this way. They set up a separate board of directors away apart from the congregation so that the congregation couldn't throw all kinds of monkey wrenches in it. But yet they were in the church so that they got all the support of the people. And they assessed their own community and its major problems and decided that probably one of the most helpful things would be to go in to buy a home, to fix it up, you know, get it spick and span, and then rent it, first of all, to a family that they screened who was maybe on welfare, or the fellow had no motivation, get back to this over here, for a job. He was, you know, the family was in a tenement and just going down, down, down instead of up. And then the stipulation was that all the rent would apply, minus interest, to his own principal. When he got out and got a job on his own and wanted to assume this home, it started out with one house, and they have now over 40 homes that are circulating. But they said whole families came alive. I mean, mothers that never sang would sing because they're in a kitchen of their own.
Isn't that something?
The kids couldn't believe not having to share a bathroom with 15, 20 other people. All of this that we take so for granted.
Yeah.
And yet no bank, no lending agency is going to make it possible for this family to have their home. I mean, this is one of the big problems we have. But now here, the church was imaginative enough to go in and begin to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the resource is there in the church to do this a million times over to its own community with its own tailor-made needs, and I think if this thing got going, like we heard back here before, we wouldn't have to wait only for education.
That's right.
But just to sit from the pulpit or anywhere else and talk, that day is gone. I don't think any church can afford that luxury and still be honest and let the love of the Lord Jesus move each church in its own way. Now, if somebody is very prejudiced or just won't get involved, let the people talk to him and to speak to him. That will change a lot faster than the preacher.
I think so too. During the Depression, which everybody suffered severely at that time, I can remember being part of many little movements, but a number of our preachers left their pulpits and became active and cooperative in social movements. One of them got wrapped up in the Townsend Plan and went up and down the state and became one of the leading lecturers of the Townsend Plan. He is today a night clerk in a cheap hotel on Washington Avenue in Minneapolis.
I bet he's on Social Security.
Very possible, yeah. Another very prominent minister in Wisconsin Lutheran minister decided this was the salvation of America, the cooperatives. Went out on it, and when the times became better, people weren't interested in listening to them. Cooperatives, that was a thing past.
Mm-hmm.
He drifted out of the ministry. So it's very easy to leave the tables or leave the gospel and serve tables.
My question is something to be answered a little maybe, and that is, if you thought there was an opportunity to cohere or let's say manipulate the congregation from the pulpit, which might help, would you have a responsibility, or would you accept the responsibility as minister, or do you think that's without? In other words, something to do with...
Would you be willing to be controversial if you believed in the
Yeah, and that there was a possibility that you really were not beating them, but manipulating them, which I think everybody manipulates or something. Is this legal or within?
I don't think it does any good.
Well, let's say that there was a possibility. In other words, direct involvement could produce these 40 homes for the Negroes. Direct involvement through the
process. I think, yeah, if it was that practical and could be solved that meaningfully, I think the pastor should challenge the whole congregation, but not just, again, in broad terms, directly to the people in the church who are, you know, handling this and say, now, tomorrow call, so and so.
Well, I guess what my question amounts to is, in theory, would you then believe in doing it from the pulpit, or do you not do it from the pulpit strictly because you don't think you can beat them in time?
Wow, what a question. Yeah.
I think we can beat them, hence we do it from the pulpit. I mean, you know, on occasion, and probably not too legitimately, and hence there's no response. I don't get any response from the pulpit. But there's a door collection or something, the announcements in the bulletin, they take care of it. But then they feel they've done it, you know. Why should they feel they're doing it for me? It's not for me.
At this point, there's a lady who's a Negro teacher, belongs to McKinney's Church, Baptist, and possibly the largest one of the Negro groups in Seattle. Was telling my wife, who teaches in the room next to hers in the school, about 30% Negro, said, you know, sometimes I've just been wondering if I should go to another church. All we get is civil rights, social involvement, anti-war, all this and that. And he's a very fine man. I know him well and everything. But sometimes I wonder if they haven't forgot that I'm a human being too, besides being a Negro. And she's very well educated and so on. I'm a human being who has a soul that needs a great deal, the same as you. If you're a minister's wife or not, you also need the same thing. You're telling my wife. And over at our house, the same thing when she and her husband were over there the other night. The very same thing, and they're very wealthy because he has a top-notch job and so on, and $15,000 a year job, and she has a $7,500 job and so on. They have no problem.
But don't we say, like with the communion, they have the body and the blood of Christ to perform their tasks in the world the following week? Well, the word should, I mean the spoken word.
Well, the word that she gets apparently
should do the
Vietnam,
same.
Anti-Vietnam.
We should be equipping them for their tasks. And my goodness, if I mean, what is the task if a person never meets a Negro in his daily work? And if this is all he's going to get, it has no meaning.
Yeah. Werner's raising his hand back.
The question I was having on a lot of these issues is, what's the matter with the power of the gospel in the pulpit? You know, I mean, why are churches split when social issues are preached? It's sort of like getting the first grade calculus. I think the first graders should split and have demonstrations too. And apparently, congregations aren't being preaching the gospel and preparing for doing anything with social issues.
I think that, Werner, that it's such an astronomical problem that the average parishioner doesn't know how to approach it as an individual. Frankly, I wouldn't know what to do. I mean, I can go talk to, be kind to a colored family and love every minute of it. That's not the answer to this problem. I think everybody's befuddled. They don't know exactly how to handle a thing. And education obviously is part of the answer, but that's not fast. And golly, there are a lot of people that don't go to churches. They'll never hear that sermon. There's more people outside of the churches that are white that'll never hear that that sermon that you may deliver.
But if they see it in the people.
Yeah.
There's just as much inequality in other countries, we must remember, as in America. You have your caste system in India. You have a similar system in Japan. There are more
colored people getting a college education in the United States and there are white people getting a college education in England, both numerically and in a percentage basis. And they are now watching us pretty closely because of the immigrants coming in from Africa. So it is not an American culture trait. It's a human trait, it seems to me. And here we come to our gospel, that when a man has power, he doesn't care who's down there, he's going to hold it down, whether he's a caste or whether he's colored or what he is.
Can't we see in America, though, that unto whom much has been given, much should be expected too? And certainly, haven't we been given so much more in America that we're...
Yeah, I'm not justifying it.
No.
I'm not saying justified, but I'm saying like the Brahmins of India. I stayed at the home of a young Brahmins, and out in front of their home were some kids playing in the dirt, playing marbles. And I said to the Brahmin there, I said, why don't you in the neighborhood here clean up that area and fix it up for the kids to play in? Why, he looked at me and I lost my mind. He said, why do that? Let them, that's their life, why take an interest in them?
If any of you want to read a well-balanced presentation of this from a Negro point of view, the one I just finished was The Choice of Weapons by Gordon Parks. He's a life photographer, had some position in government in photography at one time during the 40s, and happened to grow up in came from Missouri, went to St. Paul, Minneapolis area, grew up there during Depression days, and covered a lot of ground I've covered that's particularly interesting in that point of view. But his balance of view and the whole thing is beautiful, I felt. Choice of weapons.
The Negro actually showing us a lot of the way that we should go now. I mean, for the first time in our history. And. I mean, instead of like imposing problems, I mean programs, let's let him speak now.
Yeah.
And listen. I think that's probably the big thing.
Well, yes, right here.
I agree with that point of view. This is what I came from, is from a church where the church was destroying the Negro within the Negro community. I had a friend, he just had a tremendous personality, and everybody that met him for the first time just took a wonderful liking to him. And he had leadership ability, and he was a wonderful Christian. But here was a church where the pastor was the leader. He led the congregation if the where they had a meeting. If the board would meet, it would before the board came to a decision. It was in the or like the he put his bulletin out on about Wednesday. And the board would meet on Saturday, and the decision would be in the bulletin on Sunday. and this influence, and this man is influencing the whole American, the whole American Lutheran Church in Chicago. There, the district president. Thinks very, very highly of it, and of his type of program, and the whole what the American Lutheran Church is, their approach in Chicago is to help the poor Negro. They're giving of their financial the rich outside. Churches, they're giving lots of clothing now, especially after these riots, lots of clothing, lots of food, and everything like that.
Motivation.
Yeah.
That's a good one, really.
That's interesting.
When you live in with these poor people, you see, even the poor, this isn't what they need. They need to be taught but leadership, how to lead, how, like my nephew, he says he's really getting a blessing from church now because he's learning how to ask the right type of questions, that he can ask questions. And the Negro down in that church, he doesn't know how to ask the questions, he doesn't know where the answers are, but he's treated as a poor down Negro though. And he's really sick when it comes from the church, within the church.
You speak about disturbances and riots. We had the one Negro lady, probably well educated, one thing or another, middle aged, speak to us last Wednesday at our church in a small group, and she said it's kind of interesting that that the white community begins to wake up, though, when a few Negroes begin to blow some Molotov cocktails and make some rash statements. She said, now, like in Portland, where we have only very few Negroes, what, 12,000 or 15,000, very small percentage. She said there was a two-day rumble in Portland last summer after the hour-long hot summer in the United States. And she said there was a certain park in Albina, which is the Negro area, that was supposed to be completed, but nothing was happening. The city fathers had shut down the Caterpillar tractors, and nobody had been working there. But this little rumble of a bunch of teenagers hit the press and one thing or another. She's interested in the next day, all of the machinery that was working, mind they were going at it. Now, I'm not in favor of inciting to riot, but she said it does change things. Somebody get
at least brings it to our attention.
Yeah, sure. Sure does, boy.
Well, they aren't satisfied to wait until the slow process of assimilation and education. This is a different problem from other ethnic groups and so on.
You mentioned earlier about our, well, you might say, being leaders and our wealth and this sort of thing. I think that this can also go too far, also, because here we sit there and feed these people money, and I know we had a very good example of that in Madison, where we always clean up our Negro area, built in brand new apartment buildings and everything else, and this is all they did. They didn't educate, they didn't give them a decent job so they could afford these apartment buildings. So they moved to another area of the city, and we got the same identical situation we did before. All they did was move. And this wealth, as far as money and building, giving them something which they can't afford, either that or it'll tear it apart, because I saw that in Chicago. And so this money, I think, should go towards, if we're going to use it in this respect, towards building a school building before they build an apartment building. Educate.
Do any of you here have a colored person as a close friend?
Pardon?
Did any of you have a colored person as a close friend? Yeah, quite a few.
One. Is it worthwhile raising your hand for one?
Yes, I think it's just one. I'm not thinking of an acquaintance, but a friend.
I'd like to go to right now.
I have a lot of acquaintances, but I don't have any.